From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The White House is seizing on today's jobs reports, which shows a pickup in hiring. Nearly 560,000 people joined the U.S. workforce in May, about twice the amount in April. And that's still about 100,000 fewer than what economists had expected.
President Biden was speaking about the gains this morning, calling them historic progress.
When I took office in January, our economy was in a tailspin. Job growth had stalled. COVID was raging. Average initial claims for unemployment insurance were over 830,000 per week. Now those claims have fallen below 430,000, about half of what they were when I took office.
Meanwhile, the administration is continuing to negotiate with Republicans over its infrastructure and jobs plan. Let's get to that and a lot more with our weekly politics roundtable. Kelsey Snell is congressional reporter for NPR. Kelsey, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back to you as well.
Great to be with you.
Tolu, let's start with you. About 7 million fewer people are working than before the pandemic. But these jobs gains are more than the month before. What are you hearing from the Biden administration about this?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Obviously, when you get hundreds of thousands of people joining the workforce and adding to the labor rolls and the lowering of the unemployment rate, that's something to celebrate. The White House is happy that the number is much bigger than it was last month, which was a major miss. This still fell short of expectations, and there's still millions of people who were employed before the pandemic who are not employed now. So the Biden administration realizes that they still have a lot of work to do. At this pace, it would take until the end of next year before we reach the unemployment levels and the amount of and we recover the jobs that we lost back in 2020. So they realize that there's a lot more to do. They would have liked to see a bigger number, but they are happy that the number appears to be increasing, that the fact that, you know, more people are getting vaccinated, more people are being able to reduce some of these restrictions that were in place during the pandemic means more jobs, more economic activity, more economic growth, and they're happy about that.
The president actually spoke today. Let's listen.
The U.S. is the only major economy where projections of future growth are stronger today than they were before the pandemic hit in 2020. And in May, manufacturing activity was nearly as strong as it was in more than 15 years, stronger than in 15 years. No other major economy in the world is growing as fast as ours.
Kelsey, we're hearing what the president is saying. We heard what Tolu said. How is the U.S. doing as it digs itself out of this pandemic? I mean, it seems like there are so many factors here.
There are a lot of factors here. And one thing we're hearing a lot from Democrats on Capitol Hill and from the Biden administration as well is that they think that the country would do better more quickly if they were able to pass this infrastructure package that the White House is attempting to negotiate. Now, we know that they are in the process of these bipartisan talks right now. But, you know, Democrats say that the faster they move forward with a jobs plan, which they say the infrastructure bill is at its core, the more they say they can be done to get people back to work and to have higher paying jobs and kind of move the country forward economically.
Well, the president is meeting today with Senator Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican of West Virginia, on that very topic. She is the lead negotiator for a group of Republicans who are trying to find a way to compromise on this infrastructure plan. Here she is on Fox News Sunday.
We're responding to what the president has said. He told me on the phone just day before yesterday, let's get this done. And I think that means that he has, his heart is in this. We have had some back and forth with the staff who've sort of pulled back a little bit, but I think we're smoothing out those edges.
And Kelsey, it actually does look this week like the president is willing to budge a little bit more. Where are these negotiations headed?
Well, the president has indicated that they're willing to move the conversation away from raising the top corporate tax rate to having a minimum tax on corporations, though the White House points out this is part of their plan. They were just planning to use it to pay for some other things, not necessarily this core infrastructure bill. That is movement. It does show that the White House is trying to negotiate, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're all that much closer, because that really only, you know, introduces a completely different conversation about taxes. And while Republicans have drawn a red line at increasing taxes that were cut during the 2017 tax cuts that were passed under President Trump, that doesn't mean that they like increasing other taxes to pay for more spending. They remain focused on paying for any infrastructure spending by using unspent coronavirus relief funds, and that is a politically very, very difficult thing for Democrats to swallow. So they are still very, very far apart.
Right. And Tolu, how do you think Democrats will respond to this tax plan or this proposal, the willingness of the president here to budge on taxes?
Well, one interesting thing is that the popularity of tax increases has changed significantly over the past several years. There used to be a time where Democrats and Republicans used to sort of shy away from the idea of saying that they were campaigning on a tax increase. But as we have seen inequality increase in this country, as we have seen the wealthy do actually very well during the pandemic and corporations do very well, Democrats are leaning in on the idea that they want to tax wealthy people and corporations more, and they are digging in their heels. And I think they will be reluctant to compromise on something that they're eager to campaign on. They want to be able to say they taxed the billionaires more. They want to be able to say that they increased taxes on people who were making millions of dollars per year so that they can fund all of these social programs. They have created this campaign around this idea that they are going to take some more money from the rich who are doing very well and increase social programs and help the poor. And, you know, it is now a political issue, not only a policy issue and a financial math issue. They want to be able to campaign on this. So I think it's going to be difficult for Democrats, especially progressive Democrats, to back down from the idea of reversing some of the Trump tax cuts, increasing taxes on the wealthy, making sure, in their words, that everyone pays their fair share and that we have a fair and just economy. And it may be hard to get a deal if Democrats are not able to say we lifted taxes on the wealthy to fund these programs that we support.
Tolu, while we have you, I want to bring up another topic, and that's this vaccination effort. One thing that Biden raised today is that the administration has a goal of getting 70% of the country vaccinated by July 4th. That's just a few weeks away. But we also see the demand is going down. I mean, politically speaking, what's the value in making July 4th the deadline?
Well, there has long been within the Biden administration this goal of being able to celebrate a normal July 4th, being able to have people come to your backyard and have a July 4th because people are vaccinated, because, you know, coronavirus is largely behind us, because, you know, we can ditch our masks and get back to normal. And they have used right. that as a rubric for quite a long time. It does appear that things are slowing down when it comes to the vaccination effort. It does appear that there are states that are doing very well. There are states that are not doing as well. And the White House, the Biden administration, has not been able to penetrate some of these states, especially Republican states, states in the South, that are hesitant to get vaccinated. So even
I mean,
though
has the president really
July
addressed 4th, how they will address those number of states that have fallen behind?
They haven't done it in any kind of significant way other than just continuing their message that if you get vaccinated, you can get back to normal, you can have your July 4th party. But one of the things that's happening is that the infection numbers are going down and people feel like it's less of a threat. And even if they haven't been vaccinated, they feel like they don't have to wear their mask. They feel like the threat of the pandemic has gone. And a lot of these states have thrown open their doors and have gone back to normal even without people being vaccinated at a high level. And I don't think the White House is really focused on that. And just appears to be the approach that they're taking is to focus on the states that are doing very well and not spend as much time focusing on those states that may not listen to a Democratic president as closely as they would to a Republican president.
Kelsey, we're getting some interesting news today that Facebook has decided to suspend the former president, Donald Trump, for 2 years now. They'll reinstate if conditions change. And that's probably one of the reasons why we haven't heard much from the president since the election. But we are this weekend, actually tomorrow, former President Trump's going to speak at North Carolina's annual state Republican Party. I just wonder what you might read into this event. Could this be him trying to test the waters for another presidential bid? You know, what do we expect from a public appearance from the former president?
Well, I know a lot of Republicans I talk to are looking to this as kind of an indication of where, you know, where Trump is intending to go. There are plenty of Republicans in Capitol Hill in particular who feel like it is important for their party to have former President Trump at the top of the ticket going into the next presidential election. Many of them have thrown in their lot completely with the former president's approach to politics. And for them, it is a boon to have him potentially running again.
Tolu, what do you think? What are you looking for this weekend or tomorrow?
One thing that's really interesting is that President Trump has been telling people that he believes, you know, that's the former president, that is, that he will be reinstated as president. And I think that's something that we'll hear when he speaks, that he believes that he wants to focus on voter fraud and all of these specious issues that don't have any basis in fact, but that he wants to continue focusing on and getting the party to focus on. And it will be very interesting to hear that in his own words and hear his thoughts about the new Biden administration. Usually presidents decide not to speak, but former President Trump wants to be out there. He wants to be talking about things as if he is going to run again. So we'll have to wait and see what he says.
Indeed we will. Tolu Onarumpah of The Washington Post and Kelsey Snell with NPR. Thanks to you both.
Great to be here.
That's right, Friends is back. Well, kind of. 17 years after its final episode, the long-awaited reunion special aired last Thursday on HBO Max, and a lot of us watched, nearly 30% of streaming households in the U.S. The show is cherished by fans new and old, and media companies know this. Warner Media paid nearly $500 million to secure streaming rights for 5 years. And NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been thinking about the show's legacy, and he has another TV recommendation to share as well. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, HBO had actually planned to release this special last year, but it was postponed. Six of the cast members were also executive producers on this reunion. How did their direct oversight impact this special?
Well, you know, I don't have any direct knowledge of this, but it seemed to me that the reunion special avoided any sort of thorny controversies that the show encountered over its 10-year run. And that makes me think that the six stars had a lot of say over what kind of subjects would be talked about. One thing that we did learn is that apparently Jennifer Aniston and David Schwimmer, the actors, had major crushes on each other. And we even have a little clip from the special where they talk about it. Let's check it out.
Yeah, the first season, I had a major crush on Jen. At some point, we were both crushing hard on each other. But it was like two ships passing because one of us was always in a relationship. And we never crossed that boundary.
Why am I just so amazed by this? I can't believe it. I mean, the course of history could have forever been changed if that had actually happened.
Ross and Rachel were actually together.
Right.
Or they could have actually been together before the characters got together on the show.
Well, you know, Friends debuted, 27 years ago, 1994. It's still drawing a lot of new fans, but not every episode has aged well. I mean, the 90s were really something else.
Yeah, you know, the show did have some jokes that kind of pegged on, you know, gay panic in a way, you know, Chandler and Joey being roommates, you know, people thinking that there might be something more between the two of them. And there was even some jokes on the show and storylines that pegged off of trans panic, you know, being concerned about transgender people. All of that was stuff that you saw regularly on sitcoms in the 90s, but we feel very differently about it now. So it would have been nice to sort of hear the cast talk about that. And of course, the big controversy that was even talked about at the time was the lack of ethnic diversity on Friends. And the reunion special didn't invite back any of the women of color who had appeared on the show. You know, Lauren Tom, an Asian American actress, had appeared. And Aisha Tyler, an African American woman, had also appeared as a love interest. And she's also someone who's hosted shows, panel shows. She would have been perfect to do the sections where James Corden wound up interviewing the cast members in front of a live audience. But again, you know, another missed opportunity where they chose sort of comfortable nostalgia over any kind of substantive talk about what the show, some of the challenges that the show had during its run.
HBO must have paid these actors so much money for this special. But I'm actually reading, they said they won't appear together again. Why?
Well, you know, we'll see.
Everything's negotiable.
I mean, you know, I think they were the highest paid cast in television when the show went off the air. And reportedly, they earned something like $2 million a piece to come back and do this reunion special. So it's not like any of them are hurting for money, I wouldn't think. But I suspect some of the cast members have been a little precious about the show and about themselves. And one of the things that disappointed me the most about the reunion special is that I mostly wanted to see these six people just being friends. That would be the most special part of the reunion special for any fan.
Okay, friends, producers, if you're listening, you need Deggans to be a consultant for the next special or next show.
I promise I'll charge a lot less than $2 million.
right, exactly. Well, before we let you go, Netflix has dropped three seasons of the show Startup last week. It features Martin Freeman, who was Bilbo in the Hobbit movies, as a crooked FBI agent in Miami. Let's listen.
See, this town, all this is built on financial crime, right up to the top officials. There are people who are working very hard to make sure people like you and me don't get a fair shot at bringing them down. But if they play dirty, means we can play a little dirty too.
Eric, this show actually came out back in 2016, but it didn't take long for it to shoot up to one of the top Netflix shows. Why is it so compelling?
Well, you know, this show was a bit of a surprise. It was actually developed for a website called Crackle that's owned by Sony. So Martin Freeman plays a crooked FBI agent who finds people who are committing financial crimes and then blackmails them to get them to give him money rather than turn them in. And he stumbles on these three people, very unlikely partners who have come together to create a new form of cryptocurrency. You know, I think people should check it out. If you're looking for a great binge that is sort of a tech story, sort of a crime story, and very unexpected, I think this is a perfect show to check out over a weekend.
Well, thank you for that recommendation, Eric. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you so much.
All right. Always a pleasure.
And by the way, we're glad that you come here to get your TV news and your political news. But we realize that you have lots of other options. And if you're in your 20s or even younger, there's a good chance you're getting some of it from TikTok. The news there sounds a little different.
You gotta fight for your right to party.
No. You have no right to party, at least if you rent your party house through Airbnb. You may remember that video I did about Airbnb party bans last year. Well, the company just announced you can forget about your Airbnb summer house parties this year, too, because the company says...
That is Lisa Remillard. She and other TikTok newscasters have millions of followers on the social media platform, and they're challenging traditional ways to do the news. Femi OK is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and we talked to her about trends on social media. Femi, welcome back.
Hello there, Peter. Thank you.
Sure. So these TikTok newscasters actually have a pretty big reach. What more can you tell us about people like Lisa Remillard?
So journalists on TikTok with big followings like Lisa, they're creative. They don't take themselves too seriously. Lisa, for instance, is a veteran TV journalist. She's a co-founder of her own TV channel. She gets TikTok's short video format and promises all the news you need in 60 seconds. She has 1 million followers on TikTok, so they agree with her. I wanted to give you a little taste of another real-life journalist anchoring news on TikTok for fun. Their news mission, they say, is to appeal to middle schoolers with learning disabilities who don't know anything about government or politics. Here is Marcus de Paula.
Air travel is coming back. American Airlines says it made its first cash profit in 15 months since the pandemic began. Memorial Day was a really good day for airlines, especially at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. On the busiest day of the weekend, more than 200,000 passengers traveled through DFW.
And Femi, that was it. That was the whole news report. It's literally just Marcus reading the headlines like that. Why do you think young people are drawn to that format?
Well, the news videos are very playful. Marcus just stares at the camera. He's hypnotic. He has more than 2 million people checking in on his TikTok viewers. And this isn't traditional news, Peter. TikTok says that their mission is to inspire creativity, to enrich life. Their most popular video categories are entertainment. So if you're going to do well on TikTok, you have to bear that in mind. I'm going to give you one more example from Josh Helfgott. He has 4 million followers. He's exuberant. He's also the TikTok Queer Advocate of the Year. Here is Josh with the LGBTQ headlines.
Gay news. Joe Biden just did something for gays that Donald Trump refused to do all 4 years he was in office. The White House just issued a proclamation stating, "Now therefore I, Joseph R. Biden Jr., President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim June 2021 as Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer Pride Month."
A mouthful. Yes! What kind of influence does Josh
have? You want to cheer at the end of that.
He got it in.
Woo! Josh! That's amazing.
And what kind of influence does he have?
Oh, a lot, as you can probably hear. So the question is really, I love what Josh does. I love what all of these journalists who are finding ways to reach out to audiences via TikTok are doing. For instance, the Neiman Lab is looking and tracking journalism trends, and TikTok is definitely on their radar. And they're keeping a list of journalists and publishers on TikTok. There are hundreds of them out there, not all as successful as the ones that we kind of aired today for you listeners. But what they're doing is they're looking for the audience of the future, Peter, like the new young listeners for Here and Now. Where will they be? They're probably on TikTok right now. Where are the viewers? Where are the listeners? So although the apps might change, although the most popular apps might change, I predict that journalists and news organizations, wherever they are, whatever the app might be, journalists will try and be on that app as well. So I think TikTok journalism is out there for as long as TikTok is popular, and then journalists will look for something else because we're relentless.
So maybe the future of journalism and not so much a fad. I don't think I would be a very good TikTok newscaster, but Femi, I think you'd be great at it, to be honest.
Oh, this is why I'm not on TikTok. I would spend all my day on TikTok making video.
Well, we would love it. We would follow you. Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're so welcome.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
When she was 15, Malala Yousafzai was shot by the Taliban for wanting to get an education. She miraculously recovered and would go on to be an international symbol in the fight for girls and women's rights. The now 23-year-old Nobel Prize laureate and Oxford grad recently graced the cover of British Vogue. And it's receiving backlash in Pakistan for her comments on marriage. For more, we're joined by NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid. And Dia, what is the backlash? What is she facing from the people in Pakistan?
Right. So before we talk about the backlash, it's worth noting what Malala said about marriage in the article, which was like really chatty and personal. She said she couldn't understand why people had to sign marriage papers, why they just couldn't have a partnership. Now, this was like a bombshell in Pakistan because it's a deeply conservative Muslim country where marriage between men and women is seen as a part of being Muslim itself. It's a part of the religion. So her comments weren't just seen as, you know, like a young kid, like questioning what marriage is meant to be. It was seen as her questioning Islam itself. And so the response to her wasn't a backlash. It was like boiling rage. And it ranged from people pointing out that Malala had spoken out against a basic tenet of Islam, to accusations that she was no better than a porn star, and even threats of rape. One user who I engaged with on Twitter said he was sorry the Taliban weren't able to kill her because she'd lived to bring shame to Pakistan.
She's used to this type of hate and backlash, but her father actually said in a recent tweet that her words were taken out of context. Were they?
Yeah, Yeah, he told me the same thing in a private message. Well, yes and no. The context in the article is that, you know, she was clearly reticent about talking about love or relationships. And so, yes, she questioned whether people needed a certificate to get married. But she was also quoted as saying, you know, her mother thought she was being silly. Like, it was clearly lighthearted and came from a 23-year-old. But the issue is that Malala herself is such a divisive figure in Pakistan that there's no room for her to be interpreted with that generosity.
There's no room for that generosity. But it's also interesting because, as I mentioned, she's become this international symbol. She travels the world. People want to talk with her about this exact thing, about the right for girls to be able to speak freely, get an education, and move through the world in ways that they choose. Have you seen any changes over the last decade since she's been speaking out in Pakistan specifically?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, the thing is that Malala is this really divisive figure in Pakistan, and certainly there is a minority of liberals who love her and see her as an icon, but this isn't how she's seen for most people in Pakistan. It's almost as if because Malala says it, it's going to make people angry. It's her.
What else did this interview for Vogue reveal about her that perhaps we don't see in public?
I think it revealed, first of all, that she's an extremely impressive woman, I think beyond sort of like the very packaged image that you see of her. But it also just shows that she's a goofy 23-year-old kid. And that was sort of very charming because I think in all these big heated debates around who she is and what she is and what she represents, she's a 23-year-old girl figuring out her place in the world.
That's NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid. Thank you so much, Dia.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tanya.
And you can see that British Vote cover of Malala Yousafzai, as well as a link to the article on hereandnow.org.
In 1897, the daring Belgian commander Adrien de Jurlage set out to become the first explorer to visit the Earth's magnetic South Pole. He didn't make it. The commander and his crew got stuck in the sea ice and instead set a different record. They became the first people ever to spend an entire winter at the bottom of the Earth. Not everyone escaped with their lives or their sanity. Julian Sancton is author of a new book about the expedition. It's called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Julian, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
So what did people know of Antarctica at the time? In 1897, how uncharted was it?
People didn't even know if it was a continent. It was believed that it was very likely to be an ocean covered with ice, the same way that the Arctic is. There hadn't been a serious expedition of any kind since in the last 50 years. Its fauna, its flora, its geology, its coastlines were all but unknown at that time. And so it was quite a daunting proposition for a couple dozen men, many of whom were in no way prepared for this, to explore the great white unknown.
Yeah, no doubt. They were a bit of a ragtag group, weren't they? I mean, they didn't speak the same language. They had very little cold weather, polar experience. What was it like on board?
The ship was riven with divisions. French-speaking Walloons didn't get along with the Dutch-speaking Flemings. Then there was the resentment between the Belgian sailors, which were, you know, some of them were a notch below pirates in terms of discipline, and the Norwegian sailors that de Jurlage brought in because of their experience of cold weather. And then there was no psychological screening the way there is today in these sorts of missions.
And I think it's important to say there were also a couple of scientists on board, and after they sailed south for many days and weeks even, crew did make it to Antarctica. They made 20 landings, and it delighted everybody to be in this place that they had only dreamt of. What did the scientists find when they got off the ship?
I mean, they found a world out of fantasy. It was just, and it's one that I was lucky enough to visit a couple of years ago in December of 2018. I traveled to the Gerlache Strait, which is named after the commander of the Belgica. And it is one of the most sublime places on Earth. It really, and it hasn't changed, or at least it hasn't appeared to change in the last 120 years. Of course, the ecosystem is slowly breaking down and being threatened by climate change, but it looks identical. And what they found was a land that it looks like the, imagine if the Himalayas, somehow the sea had risen halfway up the Himalayas, and the animals there were not at all, were not used to humans, and so they could approach them. And the scientists discovered, you know, more than 100 new species. Many of them were insects, but for a scientist, this must have been pure bliss. But later, that bliss gave way to terror as when they drifted into the Bellingshausen Sea on their way to the South Magnetic Pole. And by that time, the winter ice had started to set in.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. The bliss turned to terror because at that point, the commander had a choice, right? He could have either turned back or sailed deeper into the ice and deeper into winter. Why did he keep going? Because he knew he was going to get stuck.
This is one of the questions that I endeavored to solve with this book. He knew that if he turned back without having achieved the goal of reaching the South Magnetic Pole, that he would be lambasted in the Belgian press. Or at least he thought he would be, and that scared him more than the prospect of spending a winter in the Antarctic. He knew that if he managed to survive the winter, he and his men would become the first to spend a winter in the Antarctic. And so that in itself would be something to boast about. In expeditions of this kind, great stories are as valuable a resource as gold.
Wow. So that's like pure hubris, right? I mean, how unprepared was the crew for what happened on May 16th then, when the sun goes down and doesn't come back for 70 days?
Well, I would say that only one man was prepared for that, and that man was Frederick Cook. He was the ship's surgeon. He was an American. He had spent a few grueling winters in the Arctic among the Inuit of Greenland. Even he was very much opposed to the idea of wintering in the ice. In fact, everybody but the commander was, which is why it's such a baffling decision that de Gerlache would have sailed to the south. I mean, that set the stage for a really horrendous experience in among the men, because they felt that this was something they had no control over. They felt betrayed. And in addition, when the sun sets and the cold sets in, their bodies and minds began to break down. They were subjected not just to scurvy, but to a sort of a mysterious polar malaise that made their heart rates beat erratically. Their muscles atrophied. They sank deep into depression, and some were brought to the brink of insanity. And two men actually lost their minds, one of whom never recovered. This was an incredible ordeal. It's thanks to Cook and his ingenuity.
He had an idea of what was going on. He actually introduced penguin meat into the crew's diets, much to their disgust, actually, but it helped.
Indeed, he thought back to his time among the Inuit and realized that even though the Inuit had a traditional diet of fresh meat and no access to vegetables or fruit for much of the year, that they didn't exhibit the signs of scurvy. And so he reasoned quite brilliantly that there must be something in fresh meat that contains all that the body needs to ward off the disease. And he was right. It wouldn't be for another couple decades that we'd realize why he was right. Hmm. It's that the meat of all animals, barring a few exceptions like human and guinea pig, contains vitamin C. And those who took his advice did much better. And those who refused to swallow the revolting penguin meat, which he recommended to be eaten raw, by the way, kept on sliding down the slope of scurvy and a disease that, if you don't intervene, leads inevitably to death.
So how, under those conditions, did they get out?
Well, again, our friend Frederick Cook, by convincing the men that it was somehow possible that they might extricate this ship from a floe of ice more than a mile in diameter. It was baffling to them at first. This idea was ludicrous. It was almost as if he had suggested that they flap their arms and fly home.
Well, I mean, they had even tried to blow the ice up with bombs, and that didn't work. So how could any plan work, right?
Well, yeah, he thought Cook, over the time when the sun was absent, had come to revere the sun. And so he wanted to find a way to let the sun reach the bottom layers of the ice. And so he started digging and digging in the pack ice from the prow of the ship to the closest body of water in the hopes that the sun would melt the ice along that line and that the ship could somehow pry open a passage. And though it didn't work, it inspired these men who were broken. They were depleted, exhausted, and yet they were so inspired that they came together. They came up with a plan that was even more ambitious and even more unrealistic, which is to saw an even longer canal. They ended up sawing through more than a mile's worth of ice that was as many as 20 feet thick. And it was just a masterpiece of glacial engineering that involved moving pans of ice that were the size of a soccer field and constantly combating the pressure of the ice that was trying to close this canal. So it was one of the great battles between man and nature, and eventually man won out.
Well, it is such a story of endurance, and I wonder if you look at it more than 120 years later now, like, are there things that we still can take away scientifically from the experience that these men had wintering over in the Antarctic?
Yes, and in fact, NASA has studied this, among other expeditions, for lessons to apply to the next great frontier of human exploration, which is the extraplanetary voyages and manned missions to Mars. The Belgica has been studied in particular for the ways in which they dealt with the problems of food, but also with the role played by Frederick Cook. It's been suggested that the role of the physician is among the most important, because it's his job to tend to the mental and physical health of everybody on board. And they will need to be a jack of all trades, much like Cook was. They would need to have a problem-solving, personality. And so when I spoke to Jack Stuster, who is a consultant for NASA, who is closely studied polar expeditions, he told me that when he's designing the physician role, he thinks of Frederick Cook.
Julian Sankton is author of Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. You can read some of it at hereandnow.org. Julian, thank you very much. Just a fascinating tale.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
On January 20th, the newly inaugurated president, Joe Biden, stopped construction on Donald Trump's border wall, but piles of steel, heavy equipment, and terrain destabilized by blasting through the desert still remain along parts of the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, today, Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva tells Here and Now that the Government Accountability Office will investigate the extent of the damage that construction had on the environment.
We are hoping the GAO report provides, the credible third-party independent analysis that will kind of prod some of my colleagues to remediate, restore, and in some instances remove the damage that has been done.
I'll have more on this story from the Arizona borderlands next week.
Well, this weekend is the Belmont Stakes, the wrap of the Triple Crown horse racing season. And up until this point, it's been a strange and controversial ride. Medina Spirit won the Kentucky Derby, but later tested positive for a banned substance twice. And his Hall of Fame trainer, Bob Baffert, is now banned from running any of his horses in Saturday's race. To break all of this down, we have with us Joe Drape, who covers horse racing for the New York Times. He's on the road. And Joe, this is not the kind of history horse racing actually wants to make. It kind of puts a stain on everyone involved.
Tanya, it's the darkest Triple Crown season since probably 1968, when Dancer's Image was disqualified for a similar drug overage. So it has not been a good week. The second betamethasone sample came back confirming the first. So now this whole thing gets kicked into administrative and legal court systems.
Right. You actually say that this possible disqualification for Medina Spirit from the Kentucky Derby is months away and destined to be tied up in the courts for years. How is it that a positive drug test doesn't have an immediate consequence?
Well, there can be an immediate consequence. The commission can disqualify the horse, suspend or ban Baffert. But then there's an appeal process built into that. And when that's finished, he will have the right to go to Franklin County Court in Kentucky and all the way up to the Supreme Court in Kentucky. And again, the precedence we have on this is Dancer's Image was irrevocably DQ'd 4 years after that. So that's how long that lingered in the courts.
I mean, does this signal to other trainers that there's not swift consequence for breaking the rules?
Well, that has always been the case, and that's what everybody has counted on. But, you know, we've talked before, there's this new federal bill that will set up a meaningful system with stringent guidelines and harshly enforced, and that's coming next year. You know, right now, there's some meaningful, kind of buried in all this, the meaningful punishment that Baffert is getting immediately, as Churchill Downs has said, he cannot run any of his horses for the next 2 years. And if that holds, that means for the next 2 years, he's not going to be on America's Greatest Racing Day. And that means owners who want to race in the Kentucky Derby are going to have to think twice before sending him horses.
That is significant because, as you said, I mean, he's one of the most successful guys in this industry. He's a 7-time winner of the Derby. What does this case, though, say about the sport overall? I mean, are drugs pervasive? Is this endemic of something larger?
No, I have written about this for 20 years. It's a drug culture has taken a hold of the sport, and it is fueled by trainers trying to take an edge. But it's also because of the last regulation and lack of meaningful penalties. So that has really added to it. Help is on the right way, hopefully, but it may be too late.
Oh, one other question. What's going to happen to Medina Spirit?
Medina Spirit is taking some well-deserved time off. What's happened to him is unfortunate. You know, he didn't do anything but run fast. Usually he would be in negotiations. His owners would be in negotiations for a $30 million stud deal to send him to Stallion after racing this year. But that has all been put on pause. You know, the doubt over that victory makes it tough to negotiate and sell. So hopefully we're seeing the horse back in the summer somewhere.
With that, Joe, what are your picks for this weekend for the Belmont Stakes?
Well, they are running a race, a big race, a Triple Crown race at Belmont Park. 8 horses, and I think I'm going to take the favorite, which is Essential Quality, who is the favorite for the Derby, who ran a really solid fourth despite running 64 feet further than the winner, Medina Spirit. So they still go around there. Let's get them around there safe. Hopefully this sport can clean itself up before the next time we talk.
Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. Joe, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. Have a great weekend.